Joining me today, film director James Gray, next on The Dusty Wright Show at culturecatch.com. Today's show is brought to you by our friends at Podkive. For all of your web hosting needs, visit podkive.com. Joining us today on The Culture Catch, very honored to have a terrific filmmaker, a New Yorker, a guy who has a brain, go figure, Mr. James Gray. James, welcome.
Hi, how are you? Yes. Nice to be here.
First of all, congratulations on your terrific movie.
Well, thank you.
And, you know, I will say this on the record. I told your publicist, I said, look, I have to like the movie. I don't think it's fair just to set up interviews with directors who are hot or considered, you know, in the now, unless you like their art, you know, because we're trying to propagate smart culture on our site.
Well, how would you interview someone whose work you hated? I mean, it would have
You know, you buy favors. You know how publicists are. They're trying to always buy favors out of the media, and I can't be bought. I'm sorry.
Well, I would hate to know people are talking to me hating my stuff, you know.
Or, you know, maybe they liked Little Odessa and they didn't like this movie as
much. That's possible.
Is fair.
That's
fair. You know, some people don't take to dramatic cinema. You know, it's tough for them.
Well, there's a theory about that, you know. The theory is that cinema is so intimate. And it's so much like a dream that you might have, that they look for aspirational or wish fulfillment films, because to greet a story that is not, you know, does not end perfectly with everything tied up neatly in a bow, it's almost too unpleasant to contemplate. So it's really, I think that there's some merit to that theory, because you listen to the audience watch movies with quote-unquote unsatisfying endings, and they vocalize how upset they are,
right?
Which I find interesting,
especially in New York.
Yes,
I mean, we've all been in those situations where, like, you know, look out, do you know, and then
exactly.
The big groan at the end when it doesn't go the way you suspect it should.
Well, that's exactly what that is. They're so involved in what's going on, they have such a primal identification with it, that to violate their sacred, you know, trust with the filmmaker, to end it in a way that's pleasing for them, is almost like a rebellion, you know, in the theater. Pretty interesting.
But you would think that there is a sophistication we'd like to think as New Yorkers. You know, here's the Drama Center for theater. Mm-hmm. You know, the movie making, you would think it would just extend to that. But I guess we've seen these big box office bonanza musicals and everything that, you know, it's hard for the young playwright to ascend to the neon lights.
Absolutely. I mean, well, certainly what has happened to Broadway is one of the saddest. I mean, it's nobody ever writes about it either, but it's one of the saddest stories in American culture for the last century, because you're talking about a place which showcased, you know, A Streetcar Named Desire, for example. And you have to ask yourself, well, if Broadway were in its current state in 1947... would they ever have put Streetcar Named Desire on? And the answer is probably not. It probably would have been like an off-Broadway or off-off-Broadway thing. And there's something very distressing about that, when there isn't an ability to distribute really works that have a certain ambition about them on a mass scale. And you know what? The truth is that it helps educate people. You cannot give somebody a Big Mac every day for 300 straight days or whatever, and then all of a sudden give them a piece of sushi and expect them to say, well, that sushi is delicious, I want more. They'll almost always initially say, well, that's very odd, I don't like it. And then at a certain point, there's an acquired taste that happens. So if you were giving everybody a movie that cost $150 million and had somebody, you know, wearing a cape or whatever, I mean, some of those films, Dark Knight, has some wonderful stuff in it, but my quibble is not with Dark Knight. My quibble is with the fact that that's every studio movie now.
Absolutely.
And so it has helped create an audience it's attempting to satisfy. So, chicken or egg, I mean, I don't know. You can say the audience doesn't expect or want this stuff, but truth be told, they have been educated not to expect it.
There's also this dilemma, I think, for artists. There are so many options today. When we were growing up, we didn't have the onslaught of video games tugging at us, that hyper-reality, which I think plays into this, to your point about this Cape Crusader superhero mentality with filmmaking. You know, everything has to be bigger, brighter, faster, stronger, more dynamic in this hyper-reality world. So we've lost touch with human contact. We text, we twit, we do all of these things with digital masks, but yet we forget the things that are most basic and human, which is talking face to face.
Absolutely.
And I think we miss that. So when we see a movie like your movie, Two Lovers, which examines, you know, primal emotional feelings that we've all had with mature adults, not kids who don't have life experiences, but with mature adults, it resonates if you allow yourself to be entertained in this medium.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that. I certainly hope it's true. What you're talking about is very interesting because I say that the movies that are released now have really educated the population they're attempting to satisfy. They were all movies used to be made for the entire demographic. I mean, a very elaborate demographic. It was older, younger, you know, all sorts of people, all walks of life. Because it really was the lingua franca of the culture, you know, what movies are and what they were. And today, movies are made really for 12 to 16-year-old boys because they represent the audience that goes multiple times. And so if the picture costs a lot, you want to repeat business, and they are the ones who will go. And they also will go immediately. You don't have to keep them film in theaters for a long time, which is what you have to do with adults who tend to go less immediately.
Right.
The problem with that strategy is that now that age range, the 13-year-old boy, has a lot of requests for his entertainment dollar and time. He's got his Nintendo Wii at home. He's got television on a trillion channels. He's got the internet where he can look up anything really that he wants, or he can steal something online. And to go to the movies is not necessarily his first priority. So when you think about it, and I used to say, well, movies could be like opera, where at a certain point they were the common man's medium. Mm. And now all of a sudden, nobody really, I mean, very few new operas are written every year, and it's like a spectacle where you dress up in black tie and you spend $500 a ticket or whatever ungodly sum, and you go. That may be the future of the movies, which would be very sad.
Right.
But people should be under no illusions. There is no guarantee that an art form will last forever.
Interesting. And certainly, these spectacle movies that dominate all the screens push the adult entertainment to the fringe.
Yes.
So, I mean, maybe we'll see the pendulum swing back the other way.
It could happen.
The internet is going to be the device to drive it. Now, you know, we're, just as an aside, we're launching a new service on our site where you can download this content on HD quality from our servers. So it can be a concert, it can be a movie, it can be whatever you'd like.
Right.
And a lot of the new television sets are going to be Ethernet equipped, which means you just jack your USB in.
Right.
You can dial up any program you want.
Right.
So maybe, you know, the flat screen will be our new ticket for smart culture.
Well, that's true, and I think that
although there's no replacing the big screen, obviously.
There's a couple of problems with it. I mean, and I think that's great and very liberating, but there are a couple of small problems with it. One is the big screen is a fantastic thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
The communal aspect to going to the movies, where you see the film with a large audience. I mean, the idea of somebody seeing my films, which happens mostly, of course, that's how most people watch the films, where they stay at home, they press pause, they go eat a tangerine, they go urinate, they go drink a drink, or they go answer the phone from their mom calling from Ronkonkoma or whatever.
Mm.
That is not really the way that movies should be seen. They should be seen in a large dark room from beginning to end where you are a hostage to the experience and how the narrative unfolds. And I fear that experience is going by the wayside. I'm very scared. I mean, I suppose another side of me is optimistic, which is that, you know, maybe these young kids will stop going to movies so much and then they'll start having to make pictures for adults more.
Mm-hmm.
And that could be, you know, because if you and I were talking here and it were, you know, 1962 or something, or 61, we would conceivably be saying, God, you know, all the music is, you know, the Percy Faith Orchestra, and Elvis went to the army, and it's never not good anymore, and the movies are all Annette Funicello or whatever. And then within 5 years, it's radically different. You've got the Beatles and Sgt. Pepper and the White Album and Rolling Stones and, you know, all this great music. And then you have Bonnie and Clyde, and that changes everything. So it can change on a dime.
Right.
And that's the good news. So you don't know. You don't know. You
we,
can just
we don't
keep
know.
Trying.
No, no, no. That's a very good point. There is nothing like seeing a movie or a play start to finish in its entirety.
It's great.
It's fantastic. In the setting that is... it's conducive to, absolutely.
It's fantastic.
When you were putting this new movie together, were you thinking? I mean, you were thinking because I read the press. I find this fascinating. You wrote this movie for your two stars.
I did.
Which is most writers don't think that way, do they?
Or
do you,
know,
or do you think maybe
tough
that's
to
conceit?
Say.
You know.
You kind of can't do it usually because if the actor doesn't want to do it. And usually they don't. You get really disappointed, and then you've got a movie tailored for actor X that you had in your mind. In the case of Joaquin, I would not have made the film if Joaquin didn't want to do it.
Right.
But I have a very close relationship with him, obviously, as my third film, and with him. And I just essentially got him to say yes, kind of sight unseen. I mean, he sort of knew what it was about. I described it to him. And once I knew he wanted to do it, I could definitely tailor it to him. Gwyneth, I must say, was a little bit tougher to get to commit because, you know, she has more or less retired from acting. I mean, not really. She's still going to work, but she works much less, and her requirements are very strict because she's very committed to raising her children properly and doesn't, you know, just leave them to the nannies all for 5 months. She wants to be there for them. That's a very virtuous thing. But for selfish reasons, of course, you know, I want her to act more. She has this, for my mind, a wonderful instrument, and you want her to play it. So I finally did get her to do it, and to me it was a very happy set for that reason. And you don't get that, that does not happen very often.
No, you know? People who are listening, young filmmakers, typically their schedules or other movies that get in the way. You
That's
end
right.
up waiting and waiting and waiting,
yes.
if you're that lucky.
Yes.
And then you start... filming around their schedules.
That's right.
And you can lose a lot of momentum.
Absolutely, and you can lose all momentum. It can never get made, you know.
Right.
And I was very fortunate, and I had creative control and Final Cut, and the picture was fairly small, so there wasn't a lot of financial risk involved, which let people leave me alone. And like or hate the film, it wound up becoming very much wanted what it wanted to be, you know.
Right.
I mean, it's what I had hoped it would be. And any disappointment people feel, well, that's disappointment in what it is I had intended, because nobody, you know, nobody screwed it up or anything. And if they like the film, it means it's all on my head, you know.
Right. You know, movies like this, these wonderful movies, it's great because you look backwards, in, you know, you're almost paying homage to that golden era of cinema in the 70s where you had Cassavetes, the early Woody Allens, you know, Five Easy Pieces, movies where characters really drove the stories, where we see their vulnerabilities,
right.
naked, exposed,
right.
warts and all,
right.
and the ambiguous ending.
Yes,
you know, you can draw your conclusion, which I love. You know, Lynch talked about this. You know, Lynch's movies obviously are a lot more surreal, but, you know, Dylan even said, why should I tell you what the experience is? Why can't you experience it on your own?
Well, that's part of the magic of the yeah. Of the work itself. You know, you want it to be almost like a living, breathing thing. You know, have a certain vitality to it and make a comment on the way we live, but that you can draw your own conclusions from it. You talk about this stuff, you know, from the 70s. Part of what distinguished that period of filmmaking was that it was a very director-driven medium at the time, and movies cost much less.
Mm.
So, and the business was much smaller, and so, I mean, movies cost $1 million or something, and they let you kind of do what you wanted to do. I must say, my own view is that this era may well be judged very harshly when we look back on it in 50 years or 100 years, and people say to me all the time, well, what do you mean you hate all these new movies? I said, well, first of all, I don't hate all of them. There are some that I quite like. I just don't like all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And you would never ask of any other art form. I mean, I hear people all the time who talk about music with such respect, and they hate this piece of music, but they love that one. And then they'll say, I love all movies, they say. I say, yeah, but you don't go to, you know, the Metropolitan Museum of Art and walk through and love every painting,
right?
Do you? I say, well, no. I said, well, then why do you have less respect for movies? Because that's really what it's about. You right. go to the Met, there's one painting in each room, maybe, that moves you. The rest are kind of these huge, you know, Davidian, Napoleonic battles that are really boring, and they're right. kind of brilliantly painted, but who cares? People have lower standards for movies. I think it's because they started and still are a popular culture medium. So they have low standards in which the entire idea is just, well, does it have anything that makes me laugh, or is it something that's kind of remotely diverting? And if the answer is yes, then they like it. And they get very angry and very cross with you if that's not the, you know, if you say, well, I didn't, you know, the whole picture didn't work, the ending didn't make sense. They say, well, who cares? I had this fun time doing that. And then, you know, so I think that the problem is that the culture at large was given the chance in the 70s to embrace what you're talking about and never really did. Instead, they gravitated to, I mean, Jaws, I think, is a terrific movie. It's an example of what you might call the bubblegum type movie, but really taken to a place where it's got tremendous force. But as is the case with a lot of terrific movies and a lot of terrific art, it set off a kind of bad trend. It has nothing to do, it's not Spielberg's fault at all. But what happened was that, you know, a lot of cheesy imitators came along, and certainly they were embraced as well. It's the same thing, frankly, with The Godfather, which is, of course, also one of the greatest movies ever made. But the release pattern of The Godfather was 300 theaters, which back then was considered a wide release. And so all of a sudden they started to see the magic in that and how much money it could make. And so this brilliant film, The Godfather, maybe one of the greatest films of all time, no, definitely one of the greatest films of all time, set in motion a terrible chain of events for the business.
Right. Well, that's when the marketing people get in touch with any art form. We've seen that in the music industry. It's all marketing driven, and you know, the fringe groups typically produce the greatest art.
Yes, so, I see. I think what's happened to popular music is also a tremendous tragedy. I mean, I listen mostly, the popular music right now sounds almost like exclusively amelodic, that you know, melody is sneered
There's
at.
A riff, maybe.
Yeah, it's a riff.
You know, there's a riff or a hook that's not even a fully developed hook, mind you. Because when I think of hooks, I think of the Beatles or...
Well, the Beatles were... I mean, the Beatles are the best group ever.
Right.
But they also were tremendous melody masters. I mean, they had a great sense of melody.
But yes, absolutely. To your point, I mean, can you imagine? We talked about this when I said that Obama was going to usher in smart culture. The defining moment for me was reading his interview with Jan Wenner in Rolling Stone. And he said, what's your favorite music? He said, Stevie Wonder's five albums, from Talking Book to Fulfilling This, I mean, to The Secret Life of Plants, those five albums, everything in between there.
Songs in the Key of Life.
Songs in the Key of Life, rather. Those five records, you look at consciously what they did to elevate a consciousness.
Yeah.
Melodically,
the
fact that one human being produced all of the music for the most part.
Yes.
And, you know, there's no other band besides the Beatles. Maybe you could make the argument, but the Rolling Stones were one-trick pony R&B band. You know, that it's like a body of work with a writer or a filmmaker.
Yeah.
If you could, you know, Pixar, for an example, making animated movies, very rarely misfires.
Well, Pixar is the one,
that's the one
truly bright spot in the culture. And you know what's interesting? Because they have very little interference.
Mm.
They are focused very much on dramatic storytelling, as strange as that sounds. They're better storytellers than the narrative filmmakers are, live-action narrative filmmakers are in our country. And they have a real commitment to not dumbing down the material and making it for morons.
Right.
I don't know quite why they were able to. I guess it's the distance afforded them by the animated process. They're people are able to accept it. I don't know exactly why. I can't really explain it, but there's no question that Pixar...
They're the exception.
They are the exception, and they're a beautiful exception.
I mean, think about WALL-E, existentialism.
Yes, and very strangely artful.
20 minutes without any dialogue.
Yeah.
I mean, that's extraordinary. People were to go back and say, wait, they're listening to this. Really, 20 minutes? Yeah, think about it. It's 20 minutes with no dialogue.
Yeah.
It's like 2001.
Yeah, that's really, it's really remarkable. I mean, they're great. They're great. Yeah. They're the best filmmakers. People say, well, who's the best filmmaker? I say, they are, you know.
Let's talk about your movie. I know you're tired. You've talked to death.
This is good. My first day. I'm not
oh,
tired
good.
At all.
Oh, good. We got you fresh. This is great. Joaquin, he's walking away from acting. Do you feel like, obviously, you never say never to anything, but he's being diverted into his music career. I'm looking at this movie thinking, why wasn't this held up for release till later in the season when the nominations start coming out for all the awards and everything? I mean, it's certainly riveting performance.
I love his work in it. Well, there's a reason for it. You know, it's very difficult to compete in Academy season with the big studios who spend millions and millions and millions of dollars to push their films with the Academy. And we felt that it was much better to try and achieve a certain success with the film where it could blossom on its own and not have to fight seven other movies with wonderful stuff in it. You know, it's such a crowded marketplace at the end of the year. And
you
ask yourself, well, what does this mean? Does this mean adults will only go to movies in December? And the answer is obviously no. But it's just because the Academy notes those movies the best. And
short-term memories.
I felt like, well, if the film is well-received and if people like Joaquin, then we can push for a re-release in December of 2009. And I'm not going to worry about that. What I'm going to worry about is simply making sure that the film at least has a shot in the marketplace and that people get a chance to see it. Now, if they hate it or they think it's terrible or stupid or inept, then that's fine in a way, as long as you did your best to make sure it got out there. And that's really the reason. We didn't want it to get buried in a sea of, you know, other movies that are sort of like tone, they have a like tone to them.
Well, certainly, you know, everyone says this is the graveyard period for movie releases anyway, and, you know, you're a beacon with all of them.
But that's the reason we wanted to release it, right?
Yeah.
Because, you know, they say it's the graveyard, there's nothing coming out, well, heck, you know, if the picture means anything at all, then maybe it'll stand out.
Yeah, I think it will. I think it will. One of the, I was watching it last night, and one of the things that struck me was I felt a parallel to the first time I saw Saturday Night Fever.
Interesting.
And it, having grown up in Ohio, removed from the New York experience, it seemed foreign but yet very familiar. I grew up in an Italian-American family, the tribal mentality of the Italian-Americans, the Jews, the way that things were arranged.
I find them very close culturally.
Very, very close culturally. Yeah. And there was something that reminded me of that culture of familiarity that Saturday Night Fever had.
That's interesting.
And the patriarch, the matriarch, the relationship of the characters.
Right. And also how people from Brooklyn view Manhattan very dimly.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I never thought about that until you just mentioned it. I mean, Saturday Night Fever was a huge movie for me. I think I saw it. I was very young. I was about 8 or 9 years old. It's sheer insanity to take an 8 or 9 year old to Saturday Night Fever. Although I must say, I think if memory serves me, and it usually does, I think I saw the PG version. Because, you know, they recut the film. And I think the first time I saw it, I think I saw the PG version. Now, of course, in the last 25 years, I've seen the R version.
Right.
It's a very, it's got a real sense of place and of time, that film. And for someone who is from the outer boroughs, it means a lot, because there is a certain pathos and a kind of longing that one feels. And the social class divide between Manhattan and Brooklyn and Queens is so pronounced. It's really, I think it's more pronounced than anywhere else in the world, because Manhattan is literally an island, you know, that the geographic clarity of the situation is so direct, you know, and across the river is Queens and across the river is Brooklyn, and you have to take a bridge or a tunnel to get to that beautiful place, you know, in the middle. You know, in Paris, there's a river, but it's, you know, the city is kind of spread out and its environs are not necessarily cut off by this island, you know.
Right.
So there are all these situations around the world in the world's major cities, but with New York, it is literally crystal clear. And I grew up, you know, when I would in a semi-attached row house in a working-class neighborhood in Queens, and there was a bar on the corner, and there was a big fight in front of the bar every Friday night, and, you know, out of my bedroom window over the trees, you could see the sky, tips of the skyscrapers, the tips of the Empire State Building, tips of the World Trade Center. And I always felt like, well, there's a party over there, and I'm not invited, you know? Yeah. And so that leads to a kind of pathos and a certain awareness of class, social class and class divides, and certainly that is what Saturday Night Fever is about.
Yeah, well, I think you've captured it beautifully. And,
thank you.
And the dynamic that Leonard has, that Joaquin's character has with Gwyneth, you know, she seems so elusive, yet so vulnerable and available to him.
Yeah.
And the pathos between that, between those two characters, is almost like that. Well, Manhattan seems so elusive and so far away.
Yeah.
You know, she's that connection. Mm-hmm. Even though, you know, we know that she would probably be living there if she could, if she had her druthers.
Oh, absolutely. You know, she has class aspirations, he doesn't.
Absolutely.
He's too clueless.
Right, yeah. And it's that wonderful dichotomy that just tugs at your heart.
Well, I had intended, I'd wanted them to be adults, not early 20s, you know, because I didn't want the conflict to be like, you know, he's got a girl that, like, you know, I didn't want it to be sort of a puerile struggle. I had wanted, you know, Norman Mailer has a great quote where he said, the older we get, the more we become who we are. Mm. And I feel like that's what I sort of wanted these people to be realizing, well, the end is not any longer so far away, you know, as opposed to being when you're 20, you think you're invincible. And then when you're 32 or 31, you realize, well, I've got to start living my life. And if I don't, I'm stuck. And there's a terror that creeps in. And that's what I had wanted to be beneath the absolute mm-hmm. surface of the film.
Absolutely. I think as someone who got married later in his life, I certainly felt that.
Of course.
You know,
how old were you when you got married?
My late 30s.
Late 30s. I was 34. I felt, you know, oh, I'm never going to meet anybody.
Right.
And it's just, you know, my life has not started yet. And you just...
When am I going to have my success to be able to afford a family?
Right.
You
know,
all of those
exactly.
things.
And you just feel like...
Do I want to work for my father? That was my dilemma, too.
Of course.
You know, the patriarch, the working family.
And there, you know, it's in a way, it's an unfair thing to do to... You know, but... If we had lived, you know, 300 or 400 years ago, we would be, you know, dead at 41 or whatever.
Right.
You know, our life expects. But today, it's very different. Today, people routinely live in there. I mean, if somebody died at 38, it would be like a bizarre tragedy, you know. So I think that it's unfair to have those expectations for ourselves. And I think it's okay that people are sort of waiting to get married. And, you know, but still, there's such societal pressure that it changes the way we act and feel.
Yeah, definitely. Something that struck me as well, James, was the subtle use of music. And I was so happy you did that because you let the action punctuate the emotional impact as opposed to the string swell or something else.
Yeah.
Which I just find, oh, please, you know, don't hit me over the head with the emotional cues.
Yeah, well, we had Joaquin and Gwyneth and I had all talked very much about a certain... emotional honesty, a directness, an emotional authenticity. And we didn't want, I certainly didn't want music telling the audience how to feel. Music is unbelievably effective in movies, but I think that what happened was about 20 years ago, there became a real obsession with scoring every moment as a kind of a, you know, putting an exclamation point on a dramatic idea. And I had wanted to score the moment, either score the mood of the film overall or score the moment after the dramatic moment.
Very Hitchcock.
Well, to me, the best use of music ever in the history of movies, ever. Right, you turn the shower scene, for example, right? It's like he's got no music as the figure approaches the shower curtain.
Right.
Best use of music I ever heard in a movie is in The Godfather when Richard Castellano, who plays Clemenza, says, pull over, I had to take a leak. And he gets out of the car as they're about to shoot Paulie. It's right before he says, leave the gun, take the cannolis.
Right.
And he's urinating, they shoot Paulie, and right after he's shot, you hear, that familiar waltz comes back. And it's genius because it's not scoring the moment. Mm-mm. It's scoring the moment after the moment, which means all of a sudden it's a very sophisticated approach, because all of a sudden it means this is what life is for them. Life goes on, that sort of fabulous, inexorable quality to that waltz that Nino Rota wrote. And so I feel like that to me is a sophisticated use of music, not to score a picture like a cartoon. You know, in cartoons, that's how they score it, right?
Right.
Bugs Bunny walks up, when he walks down, that's scoring the moment.
Right,
you know?
Absolutely. And there was no better master than Stallings in doing that.
You know, he was a genius. I'm not bad-mouthing him.
No, I completely understand what you're saying.
And it has been done brilliantly. I mean, John Williams, I mentioned Jaws before. I mean, John Williams did it in Jaws.
Yeah.
Absolutely. That's incredible.
Right. And it's very rare, but, you know, Europeans seem to take this approach often.
They do.
They let the characters find the setting. They walk in and out of the frame. They don't, you know, it's just... It's a slice of life. You really feel voyeuristic in some instances when you're watching movies.
Well,
like
absolutely. I mean, look, European cinema was definitely the thing that we tried to steal from a lot. And I love European movies, particularly from the 50s and 60s. And they have the drippings, I would say, of their centuries-old cultures. And
right.
It seems to be a more lived-in world and a kind of a tremendous sense of history to those movies. And I respond quite a bit. They seem to be made, and maybe this is unfair, but they seem to be made with less of a mercenary idea.
Mm.
So they tend to pander less. This doesn't mean it's all roses in Europe. I mean, especially now, certain cinemas, like the Italian cinema, used to be my favorite, and today is in real crisis mode. Although maybe it's getting a kind of a comeback with a couple of interesting movies. But for the most part... I would say that my taste in movies is either 70s American cinema or European pictures from the 50s and 60s.
Right. Absolutely. You know, it's funny, we screened Fellini's movie Toby Dammit.
I love it.
And I'd never seen it. I didn't know anything about the movie.
I love it.
And I just thought, wow, if you want to distill all of his movies into one short movie, and you can only watch one.
I think he thought that was one of the best things he'd ever done.
Really?
Yeah, it has an incredible moment which Scorsese... ripped off wonderfully well in Raging Bull, where the camera keeps moving past the boxing ropes and settles on the blood dripping. And Toby Dammit has that shot where it's on the string that's cut his head off.
Right.
Terrence Stamp is remarkable in the film. It's a haunting film. It's only about an hour long, right? About 45 minutes,
if
something
that.
Like that. Yeah.
50 minutes, I
50
think.
50 minutes.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think he made that as one of three short films.
Absolutely.
You know, one by Louis Malle and Roger Vadim.
Vadim, and they're all adaptations of Edgar Allan Poe.
Edgar Allan Poe.
Right.
I haven't seen it in years. I mean, you're making
it. I bought it recently because I was so fascinated with Toby Dammit. And
it's fantastic.
It is just, I mean, if you're listening at home, you want to buy this trilogy. It's worth it just to see Terrence Stamp. Now, going one further, when Stamp did it originally, he did it in English.
That's right.
So if you can find a copy of that with him in English,
yes.
Because, you know... And then watch the YouTube interview with Stamp, talking about his experience.
I've not seen.
Oh, you have to watch that.
YouTube with Terrence Stamp talking about Fellini.
Talking about that movie specifically, and you know, he said he gets on the set, and you know, he's looking for guidance, and the great master doesn't say anything to him, and he's trying to find his character and what he would do. Watch, you have to watch just to hear what he talks about, and what his direction is. It's just priceless. I don't want to ruin it. It's Stamp just shares a wonderful Fellini moment.
Fellini is my favorite director of all time.
Right.
I've seen everything he's done, and for me, I mean, everything is great to me. I mean, the only thing I don't like that he ever did, I don't like Satyricon. Satyricon to me feels like a put-on, you know, it feels distancing and not too interesting to me. Everything else I love, and I really adore those 50s movies he made, and I rip off La Strada, you know, the ending with Anthony Quinn on the beach. Totally stole from that for the ending to Two Lovers. And
fantastic
also,
moment, by the way.
Joaquin looking into the camera, I stole from Knights of Cabiria.
I like how you say stole and not borrowed.
Oh, well, you steal from the best,
absolutely.
You know, everybody does. You
absolutely.
Know? So, and those movies, what they have, and Fellini was really able to do this in such a beautiful way, Evie Deloni as well. There's no irony, there's no sneering at the characters. There's such a love for the people in them. There's such a generosity of spirit.
Mm, Absolutely.
And if you can communicate that, that's a really beautiful thing, I think. And if I make a movie that's one-tenth as sort of generous to its people as he does, then I can really be a happy person, because to me it's the most ethical position for a work of art, if I may use that word, to take.
Well, something else that I think is really wonderful about your movie is there's a timelessness. There's the fable quality. You're not caught up in the devices of the day, you know, aside from what is texting and, you know, what it's become.
Right.
And dare say, I don't know how you would handle that device anyway, because it's so part of our culture now. But the way it was shot, your DP's use of lighting.
Right.
You talked about it, so you tipped your hand to how you would see the tip top of Manhattan, but the whole rear window dynamic
sure.
that you've got going on.
Sure.
And there's a wonderful moment of vulnerability with our femme fatale, which I won't share with the listeners right now, which I just thought was so tender and so insane, that one moment where she exposes herself.
Right.
It's so dynamic. Such a great scene.
Well, I'm glad you liked it. I mean, my own view is that filmmaking at this scale is not a marathon, but a sprint.
Mm-hmm.
And you focus on almost stripping away cleverness. You don't want twisty stories. They tend to age very poorly, because mm-hmm. once you find out the twist, then watching them again tends to be a very mechanical exploration.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, did that plot point equal that ending? You know. So I wanted almost a stripped down and austere story where the narrative was not tricky at all, but deceptively simple, so the picture could sit on two different levels. You could watch it just seeing it as the story that it is, and also watch it with an understanding that there's a subtext, hopefully, there about desire and people's vulnerability. So one hopes the film ultimately feels timeless, and the word fable, by the way, was definitely the word that we all used going in. Something that almost felt so simple that it was like clean. You know, when you eat the best food is very simple, you know, where the ingredients are very
Absolutely.
Good, and the best paintings tend to be sometimes incredible. I mean, Guernica is not simple, but usually very Edward Hopper's best work, very
right.
simple and kind of you know, a certain austerity. That's if you can achieve it, it's beautiful, because you know Edward Hopper, the painter, once said, he said, my aim with painting is the most exact transcription of my most intimate impressions of nature. And what that really means is to strip away all the artifice and try and reveal oneself completely. So as a movie, you hope that, you know, when you make a film, you hope that it can achieve at least some aspect of that.
And absolutely, in this type of movie making, you revisit it to appreciate the subtleties of the performances. You know, Joaquin's facial gestures, Gwyneth, the way she moves in and out of a scene.
Right.
You know, again, it's not being sensationalized
right.
in a typical dramatic moment with lighting cues, music cues, all these things that we've come to expect.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to work against that. I have a big contrarian bone in my body. I suppose if everyone were making these types of films, I might want to go in another direction, but I just don't see them. So, and you do try to make the films that you like to see.
Right.
And this is the kind of movie I mean, hopefully, if I pulled it off, I mean, you know, you never ever find out, because you can't watch your own movies. But it's the kind of movie, at least that I tried to make, was the one that I like best.
Well, I think you've achieved that.
Well, thank you.
James, tell me about the connection with White Nights.
Well, it's inspired by the story, but the inspiration is so loose. I mean, it's really taking the elements of the main character. And Dostoevsky had written that novella a long time before some of his really great work. I think it was one of his first real published stories. And I pulled it off the shelf one night, a little light reading. I pulled off some Dostoevsky. And I found the character fascinating because he is so troubled and conflicted and yet very empathetic. You understand him completely. You feel what he feels. You've been through it. And today, you know, if Dostoevsky were writing today, his characters would be treated with a whole host of elaborate pharmaceuticals. But back then, of course, it was just a person who was slightly off-center, you know, and you just dealt with your own psychological dysfunction. I just feel that that is the essence of drama, because he's both conflicted internally, and yet he always has an external struggle that he's involved with as well. So I thought that it would be a perfect way to make a picture, a timeless picture, as you put it, but almost a fable about love and about desire and the fickle nature of desire, and how we are, our quest for happiness is always so fraught with potholes because we never really have distance from ourselves. And Dostoevsky's writing really puts front and center a kind of genuine human pathos that I found that I understood really deeply. And there has been a movie made of it. There's been several, but there's been a movie made of it by Visconti with Marcello Mastroianni and Maria Schell, which is very beautiful movie. But it's very different. It was shot all on the sound stages of Cinecittà, and it's right. very surreal. So I had wanted to make a film that was austere and on location, all on location, nothing built. And I know why Visconti did what he did, because he wanted it to be almost dreamlike and, you know, oniric or something, and feel like that love, which is a state of almost absurd, you know, preposterous human behavior anyway, it would almost justify the kind of absurd leaps of faith that we make when we are in love. And the challenge for me was to not do that. Mm. Now, Visconti is one of my favorite directors of all time. I mean, Rocco and His Brothers and The Leopard and Senso and so many of his movies are so brilliant that it was a real challenge to try and tread near where Visconti, used to walk. But I saw the movie, loved it, and read the book many years ago. And then at a certain point, I tried to forget it all and just hope that some of the inspiration from it shows through without ripping it off.
Well, maybe The Leopard is the next to rip off.
That movie wouldn't that be is fantastic? Beyond yeah. divine. That movie is so great.
I mean, more people should read the book.
The book is great. I mean, the movie is only the first half.
Right.
I don't know if you've seen the movie or read the book, but I just think that both are great. Yeah. The movie in its own way is the best filming of Proust ever. You know, I've read two of the Remembrance of Things Past novels. They're very difficult, you know. Swan's Way is incredible.
I couldn't get through.
It's very difficult, right? Like
very,
the first 100
pages. It's like
pages.
The first time you read Ulysses.
I've never read Ulysses.
No,
I can't
try. You just pick it up and you go away and you try to get back into it.
It's work.
It's work.
But sometimes, you know, great stuff is work. Yeah. And Remember the Things Past, you know, anyone who's familiar with Swan's Way, they'll know that literally the first 100 pages is dedicated to him getting up,
right.
him waking up. And you say, well, how can that be? But it is. It's kind of magnificent, but it's certainly arduous. And the Leopard doesn't have that, and yet somehow still has captured that sense of longing and loss and realizing that we are alone in the world. It's just a beautiful, beautiful film. And I know that it's one of, you know, Scorsese's favorites, you know, and he talks about it chapter and verse. It's a remarkable movie.
Mm. Well, James, I want to thank you for
giving
us this time. And we look forward to continued success and fantastic movies from you.
I hope this
finds a big audience for you.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
Dusty Wright with The Culture Catch. We'll see you soon. I get into it. I mean,
almost dreamlike and, you know, oniric or something. And feel like... to feel like that love, which is a state of almost absurd, you know, preposterous human behavior anyway, it would almost justify the kind of absurd leaps of faith that we make when we are in love. And the challenge for me was to not do that.
Mm.
Now, Visconti is one of my favorite directors of all time. I mean, Rocco and His Brothers and The Leopard and Senso and so many of his movies are so brilliant that it was a real challenge to try and tread near where Visconti used to walk. But I saw the movie, loved it, and read the book many years ago, and then at a certain point I tried to forget it all,
right,
and just hope that some of the inspiration from it shows through without ripping it off.
Well, maybe The Leopard is the next to rip off.
That movie that be is fantastic? Beyond yeah. divine. That movie is so great.
I mean, more people should read the book.
The book is great. I mean, the movie is only the first half.
Right.
I don't know if you've seen the movie or read the book, but I just think that both are great.
Yeah.
The movie in its own way is the best filming of Proust ever. You know, I've read two of the Remembrance of Things Past novels. They're very difficult, you know. Swan's Way is incredible.
I couldn't get through them.
It's very difficult,
it's
right? Like
very,
the first 100
it's like
pages.
It's the first time you read Ulysses. It's
yeah,
like,
oh, I've never read Ulysses.
No,
I can't.
You just pick it up and you go away, and you try to get back into it. It's work.
But sometimes, you know, great stuff is work. Yeah. And Remember the Things Past. You know, anyone who's familiar with Swan's Way, they'll know that literally, the first 100 pages is dedicated to him getting up,
right.
him waking up, and you say, well, how can that be? But it is. It's kind of magnificent, but it's certainly arduous. And the Leopard doesn't have that, and yet somehow still has captured that sense of longing and loss and realizing that we are alone in the world. It's just a beautiful, beautiful film. And I know that it's one of, you know, Scorsese's favorites, you know, and he talks about it chapter and verse. It's a remarkable movie.
Well, James, I want to thank you for
giving
us this time, and we thank look you. Forward to continued success and fantastic movies from you. I hope this finds a big audience for you.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
Enjoyed my interview with director James Gray. If you like our programming, please leave comments in the iTunes directory or at culturecatch.com. This is Dusty Wright for culturecatch.com. Converge is the word.